online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon, I'm Jodie Gunders, filling in for Callie Buchanan today. It's another scorcher, that severe heatwave warning still in place for much of the state. You'll hear from the BOM in about half an hour, and I'll keep you posted with any fire and storm concerns around the state. But what's better on a hot, dry day than a bit of cold, crunchy iceberg lettuce? You'll hear soon from a couple of lettuce producers about how they went from being price takers to price setters with the supermarkets. And speaking of the supermarkets, the ACCC inquiry has commenced its public hearings this week, and that's where we kick off the Country Hour today. I'll be with you until one. It's great to have your company. The peak body representing food and grocery manufacturers, a sector now worth $163 billion, has given evidence at the ACCC Supermarkets Inquiry. In the witness chair for the Australian Food and Grocery Council were its CEO and its Director of Competitiveness and Growth. Tanya Barden and Samantha Blake answered questions from Naomi Sharp SC, the council assisting the inquiry, for more than 2.5 hours before then entering a private session after they objected to answering this question in public.
Coles and Woolworths have told the ACCC that their supermarket businesses are high volume, low margin businesses. What have your members, what's the feedback of your members been about the, I suppose, the net price of the goods they supply to the supermarkets and the retail prices of those same goods?
I would prefer questions related to two major players' profit margins and pricing to be taken in private hearing.
So the witnesses objected to or not going to answer that question. Do you want to expand further on that or...?
It's just quite a narrow question focused around two major players whom the AFGC does need to collaborate closely with for the benefit of suppliers and consumers on a number of different matters. And I think in those interests it would be better for us to answer those questions in a private hearing to maintain those constructive relationships.
That's Tanya Barden, CEO of AFGC, responding to ACCC Deputy Chair Mick Keogh there. Back to what the council's witnesses could answer in public. They were asked about the growth of private labels.
What's in it for branded manufacturers to manufacture private labels for supermarkets?
Absolutely. Firstly, broad church of players out there, so there will be some companies that will have policies that they will not manufacture private label. However, there are many companies out there who will choose to manufacture private label because they have spare capacity in their factories, they need to reduce their overhead costs, and it's another way of being able to put volume through manufacturing plants.
Doesn't it result in the manufacturer making products which compete with its own branded product?
Yes, absolutely it can.
And hence why some brands will do it and some brands don't.
Are you receiving any feedback from your members that private label products are undermining the market power associated with branded products?
I'd say that they're a very strong competitor, and I think particularly at the moment in cost of living, we've seen consumers increase their purchasing around private label products.
So we have seen a growth in private label products. Is that simply to address cost of living?
Yeah, it's that. It's absolutely about providing value to the shopper, particularly at the moment. But it is also about competition, particularly with Aldi and their strong private label offering.
The ACCC quizzed the Australian Food and Grocery Council on the process involved for suppliers seeking a wholesale price increase from retailers.
So just looking at that three-month time frame, if an application is made in week one and it takes 3 months to resolve the application, what happens in the meantime to
the cost? Well, the retailer continues to purchase at the old price for that 3 months. So the supplier is bearing, as Tanya said, the cost for any price increase that they maybe have bearing during that period of time.
This was particularly difficult through the rapid inflation that we've had over the last few years because suppliers were subject to a significant escalation of cost increases, and I'm happy to come back later on and outline some of those. But they weren't able to recover those costs for a delayed period of time, so they're having to absorb those costs through that period.
Are there ever requests to decrease the wholesale price?
Yes, there are, and I think particularly at the moment with the cost of living pressures, retailers are initiating conversations where there have been some decreases, for example, in some commodities. I think what's important to note that where we outline the timing of the cost price increase process can take 12 weeks or more. For a price reduction, often the retailers will seek to negotiate with that within a much shorter period of time.
So that means that the price at which the supplier supplies to the supermarket decreases quite quickly.
That's right. It's slow to rise, quick to fall.
The ACCC then asked the Australian Food and Grocery Council about the impact it would have on suppliers if they suddenly lost the ability to supply either Coles or Woolworths.
That would significantly impact the viability of the business. It's very difficult if you've lost nearly half of your business to find an alternate customer. It's not easy to just replace with export or other channels. So that would tend to question the long-term viability of that business, and it may cease to trade.
So that's Tanya Barden and Samantha Blake from the Australian Food and Grocery Council at the ACCC Supermarkets Inquiry today. Fruit growers are heavily reliant on supermarkets, that inquiry, those hearings heard today. The ACCC is looking at supermarket price setting, profitability and supply chains. Fruit Growers Victoria Industry Development Officer Michael Crisera and apple and pear grower Peter Hall fronted the hearings today and were questioned by Senior Counsel Naomi Sharp. Mr. Crisera said his sector is heavily reliant on supermarkets as export opportunities for some fruits are limited.
So there's definitely some opportunity in the stone fruit and cherry sectors. Apple and pear, not so much. We export between 5 and 7% of our pears, and we'd be lucky to export 2% of our apples.
And do you have anything to add to that, Mr. Hall, based on your long experience?
Yeah, certainly in terms of processed fruit, it's basically any grade that can't make it to a central market or a retailer. It'll end up in a juicing position. It's really cost recovery. There's not a lot of value. You wouldn't grow it for that market. In terms of the canning situation, it's really a very, very small volume of fruit that goes to the canning operations now. And I'd agree with Mick in terms of export. It's a very low percentage of apples and pears, but there are some opportunities definitely for stone fruit and definitely cherries. And that's basically because of the cost structures in Australia. Our wage rates are probably some of the highest in the world. Our compliance costs are some near the highest in the world. We're being held to very exact standards in terms of environmental quality, chemical quality, and the other issues that go into fruit. So it just makes us an expensive place to grow fruit.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Crisera. How dependent are fruit growers on the supermarkets as a supply channel?
If you grow apple and pears, very dependent. 80% so dependent, I would say.
And what's your view there, Mr.
Crisera? You're totally dependent. I mean, it's where the majority of fruit and vegetables are sold, or fruit that we grow is sold in Australia. I don't think I know. I might know some very, very small historical growers that just supply the central markets, but be very few people that don't have at least some of their fruit, and usually a large percentage of fruit go to the chain stores.
Are there particular grades of fruit that go to the central markets? I might ask you, Mr. Hall.
Yeah. Sometimes you can send premium fruit to the central markets. They're probably, you get a higher value if there's a good market conditions. You tend to sell your premium fruit and your second grade fruit that's not suitable for the chain stores. So that's an opportunity to get some cost recovery on fruit that's not suitable for the grades that are required at chain stores. The price you receive are just dependent on what buyers in those markets are prepared to pay for that quality of fruit. Whether if it's a premium product that's specially prepared, you'll get a premium for that. If it's second grade fruit, well, you'll just get what the market conditions are determining at the time. It's usually cost recovery.
What happens if a supermarket rejects fruit that's supplied to it, can it then be sold on the central market?
Yeah, that can happen. If there's a rejection, that fruit can then, you know, it's a pain in the neck, but you take that fruit from the DC that's rejected it, and you might go to a central market, or you might put it in a central market place, and it might be reworked. They might go over that fruit and make it suitable for the DC, and then take it to the DC. And in some cases over the years, it was rejected on a Friday, and then Monday they'd have another go and they'd take it. So sometimes it might have just been the vagaries of the inspector at the time of the DC, or perhaps they had a lot on their floor and they didn't want any more. I don't know. But from time to time, that does happen.
And when you, I'll come back to you, Mr. Crisera, when you speak about a DC, I take it you're referring to a supermarket distribution centre.
Yeah.
When you do have a rejection, it really does depend what packaging it's in.
If
it's in a Coles or a Woolworths crate, you wouldn't be able to resell it on the wholesale market.
No.
You'll have to bring it back, rework it and go back again. So because some suppliers choose to pack into cardboard packaging that's flexible to be able to supply both of the retailers but also the wholesale market. Just makes it a lot easier logistically within packing sheds to pack into cardboard, but it tends to be at a higher cost than putting it into a crate.
That's an important consideration actually, because both chain stores have different, Coles and Woolworths have different crates. So once it goes in a Coles crate or a Woolworths crate, it's awfully expensive to take it out of that crate and put it in a different crate. It's all been specially packaged. So if you get rejected and it's in a crate, it'll have to go back and be reworked. It can't be sold on the wholesale market.
Victorian apple and pear grower Peter Hall speaking at the ACCC hearing this morning. It was also revealed the supermarkets have several tiers of suppliers, and for Coles, this might mean farmers have no say in the price they receive from the big retailers.
The ACCC has received feedback that when it comes to dealing with the supermarkets, there are two tiers of supplier. There are the tier one, who have a vendor number, and the tier two who don't have a vendor number and have to supply to the supermarket through a tier one.
Yep.
So is that right?
That's correct. That's pretty much the Coles model. It's not the same in Woolworths, but the Coles model is you have your tier one, tier two and a tier three, I think. A tier two can supply Coles through a tier one, so they can pack their product and then it's pretty much unsold for a commission via a tier one.
And what do the tier three suppliers do?
Tier three can purely...
Maybe they're just growers.
Just growers.
Vendors that can be aggregators, so they can take a product from other packing sheds, put it together and sell. So I was a tier two supplier in that sense. We supplied a vendor packed product. We got orders. We actually delivered to the DC or arranged all that. They just made the connection between us and the chain store. I think quite a lot of fruit's actually done that way.
Does that mean that when you're a tier two supplier, you're not negotiating directly?
No. You won't negotiate directly with Coles. What you will, if you're big enough, you'll be privy to those negotiations because the tier one supplier will ask you, we need a supply, would you be prepared to meet this price? And then so you'll be involved in a negotiation in terms of being able to meet that supply. And sometimes you'll also, be part of meetings with the chain stores as well. I mean, you're a key supplier in a sense. I think chain stores, it's in their interest and it's fair enough. They'd like to know who's supplying their vendor so they can look at what, they're trying to build supply models. They need to understand who their vendors are getting fruit from so they can build a confidence that they're going to get enough supply for the year's inventory.
But does it mean that only the suppliers with vendor numbers are negotiating with the supermarket about price?
Yes.
I see. And Mr. Crisera, you mentioned it works a bit differently for Woolworths. What are the differences?
Yes, so Woolworths don't tend to have a tiered system. If a vendor chooses to procure fruit from another grower, depending on their, I suppose they'd have to be an approved supplier with all of the, food safety standards required. So they'd have to come in under the HARPS and the Fresh Care model.
And sorry, what's HARPS and Fresh Care?
So Harpsingham Fresh Care is your food safety compliance.
Fruit Growers Victoria Industry Development Officer Michael Crisera there. You're listening to the Country Hour.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Nearly 30 years ago, Queensland lettuce growers Geoffrey and Anne Storey grew sick of daily price ups and downs associated with selling into the fresh market, in particular supermarkets. After looking at trends around the world, they went after a new market segment, supplying sliced lettuce to quick serve or fast food restaurants. Now the Storeys grow 18 million heads of iceberg lettuce every year and negotiate price just once a year. As Landline's Pip Courtney reports, being price setters instead of price takers has allowed the business to grow and grow.
Geoffrey Storey's a vegetable grower. He specialises in lettuce, just like his grandfather, who grew them for the fresh market.
He came to Australia early after the Second World War. He started with a little farm in Toowoomba, 5 acres. And him and my grandmother and one or two helpers, they would grow lettuce.
2 generations later, and this is what their grandson and his wife Anne have built. A multi-million dollar lettuce growing and processing operation spread across 4 farms around Toowoomba in southeast Queensland. It's 2 businesses, really. An outside farming one, where 70 staff plant, sow and harvest lettuce, spinach and rocket, and an inside processing one, where salad greens are washed, sliced and bagged by 50 staff. After going through here, the value of each lettuce has increased 2.5 times. The couple moved into processing 30 years ago after getting sick of riding the price roller coaster of the fresh market.
You actually didn't know whether you're going to make money this week or next week or for the whole year, right? It got to the stage where you could go a whole year and not make money.
To get out of the traditional central market system, in the early 90s, the couple looked overseas for inspiration. There they saw 2 emerging trends, the boom in fast food franchising and growing demand for prepped fruit and vegetables. And that's where they headed. This $10 million processing facility, which opened 4 years ago, is a quantum leap from their very basic start. Now, AI, robots and high-tech cameras mean not as many staff are needed to slice, sort and bag the delicate greens. The Storey's son, Nathan, is a mechatronics engineer, which means he's fluent in mechanical, electrical and software engineering and robotics.
Most machines have their own brain. Over the top of that, we have some other controllers that are making sure that as a group, everything's happening the right way.
Produce from here goes to some of the best known food outlets in the country.
So that's all the big brands you can imagine.
And it absolutely works better with long-term relationships as opposed to today we've got a customer for it and tomorrow we don't.
We supply Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria. So we have about, in effect, about 2,500 stores that we would supply.
McDonald's is a fairly recent customer.
Not easy to become a McDonald's supplier, and they've certainly stood up to that challenge as they came into our family 5 years ago.
McDonald's Senior Director of Supply Chain, Tom Marnie, says reliability is crucial.
Making sure it shows up and that we get supply is critical, and that's not easy in produce, whether it's a rain event or a hail event, there's always something, but the Storey family have done a good job.
Supplying the big brands has given Geoffrey and Anne what the fresh market and supermarkets couldn't.
Every lettuce we can see here has a home.
Yes.
And you know what price you're going to get.
That's exactly right. They need products like ours every day of the year. Daily we plant about 100,000 heads of lettuce. Across the year we do about 18 million.
So if you're planting 100,000, does that mean that you also are somewhere else harvesting 100,000 a day?
That's exactly right. So across the properties we are planting every day, transplanting every day, that little seedling, and every day we're harvesting.
They built the factory bigger than required. So, jokes Geoffrey, when money was needed to expand in a decade's time, it would be Nathan's problem. Demand's grown so much, they need more space after just 4 years.
The next stage will give us roughly a 50% increase in capacity.
You'd think that Anne and Jeffrey, who are both in their 60s, would be starting to ease up. No. They've just bought a Brisbane food processing business and plan to expand its product range and customer base. Anne was shocked at how big the market for diced, sliced, chopped, shredded and peeled fruit and veg is. The food service world has radically changed.
Many people are quite prepared to buy a processed product so that they actually don't have to do that particular function in-house. They might do the final cooking or they might do the plating out, but the preparation is actually done off-site.
Could you ever imagine being a price taker again?
Not for me, no. That's not a position I ever want to be in again.
That was Jeffrey Story, the Managing Director of Story Fresh with Landline's Pip Courtney. And you can see Pip's story on Landline this Sunday at 12:30 or catch up anytime on iView. It's 25 past 12.
The December issue of Gardening Australia celebrates the best bloomers of the season. Create gifts from the garden, grow your own salad ingredients and explore a hedge maze. And in Organic Gardener, there's easy to grow herbs and veggies, plus water saving and shade ideas. Learn how to start a garden on a budget and even raise your own chicks. Gardening Australia and Organic Gardener magazines. Available from newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour. Jodie Gunders with you through until 1 o'clock today. Very shortly, you'll hear from the Weather Bureau with a full wrap of the weather. First, though, the number of Pacific workers employed on Australian farms has fallen more than 20% since new rules requiring guaranteed work hours came into effect. First introduced in July last year, the current rules mean workers from Pacific Australia Mobility, or PALM, scheme must be given a minimum of 120 hours of work averaged over 4 weeks. Figures from the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations show that since then, the number of PALM workers in agriculture dropped from a peak of almost 22,000 to around 17,000 in July this year. By comparison, the total number of workers across all industries in the scheme fell 6% in the same period. The opposition spokesman for international development and the Pacific, Michael McCormack, tells Ashley Bagshaw he believes the scheme was working well before the changes.
It's made such a difference. It replaced previous seasonal workers programs through the Pacific. It was working well, the conditions were right, and yet incomes labour and at the behest of the unions changed the configurations around how many hours workers were going to be required to work. The changes were only going to be put in place for 12 months until July 1 next year. But the trouble is, many of the workers have left. Many of the farmers have stopped using the scheme. And in Senate estimates this week, we heard that the number of workers in agriculture has fallen by more than 20%. So there's a number of workers now not taking part in that. That's not only bad for agriculture here in Australia. It's also has an effect on the remittances being paid in those Pacific nations and Timor-Leste, those workers who come to Australia, who've always been part of this productive scheme, and it's just so disappointing. This number has drastically fallen, and it's simply not good enough.
And so you see this change as a direct result of the changes to the PALM scheme deed and guidelines and to those changes in the minimum number of hours that have to be paid?
Well, absolutely. You know, you would have just thought that they would have done a little bit better, done a little bit more homework with this Pacific scheme, because our Pacific partnership needs to be everything it can be. It needs to be the best it possibly can be. Agricultural work is seasonal. It's weather dependent. Farmers have simply hired less workers because of the changes, and they've gotten out of the regularity of using this PALM scheme, and it's going to be tough to get them back in many, many places. And, I fear that come July next year, the scheme might even revert to what they wanted originally, but whatever is the situation, we need to do better, and we need to make sure that it's there for our Pacific workers, for our Pacific families, to help them.
Now, when these changes were implemented, they said that it was essentially to improve Pacific workers' conditions and to strengthen workplace protections. Do you think that there is some validity in preventing exploitation in the workplace?
Look, any exploitation, there were always provisions in place for those workers to alert authorities that this was occurring. and authorities were very quick to stamp it out, whether that was under the Gillard government, whether that was under, indeed, our government. We moved very quickly, authorities moved very quickly to stamp out anything in that regard. And look, workers were well treated. They were well paid. The remittances formed the majority in some cases of GDP in some island nations. I mean, it is crucial and critical to not only the Pacific Island nations' GDP, but also to our farmers to be able to get that work done. Those occupations that can otherwise not be filled by Australian workers. And the scheme has worked really, really well. It's been desired by Pacific people. It's been fruitful for Australian farmers and agriculture and the horticultural industry, broadly speaking. And there were provisions in place to stop any exploitation.
And so this is something that you do directly see as making it less workable for farmers when it comes to employing these workers, and you think that's why farmers are stepping away?
I do. And what the farmers can be guaranteed and what the horticultural industry and others can be guaranteed is that if we're elected at next year's election, then we'll put in place the provisions and the entitlements and the right regulations such that we restore the scheme to what it needs to be.
Coalition spokesman for International Development in the Pacific, Michael McCormack, speaking there with Ashley Bagshaw. The Department of Employment and Workplace Relations declined to answer the ABC's questions. However, in a media release from back when the changes were announced last year, Minister Tony Burke said workers would benefit from enhanced safeguards that supported regular income and that approved employers would continue to have access to farm workers to help fill labour gaps in rural and regional Australia when enough local workers could not be found.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app, this is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
It's a pretty hot day where I am, and that's Toowoomba. So I'm sure across the state it is quite warm indeed. Phelim Hanafy is at the Weather Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, indeed.
Those hot conditions are persisting?
Yeah, indeed. Right the way from the southeast up to the central interior and the north and interior and northwest of the state as well. It's all ahead of a trough. The trough itself did move through parts of the southern interior. That's the Maranoa and Warrego. So we've had a little bit of a southwesterly change here. So it has dropped temperatures for Charleville and places like Roma as well and St. George, but back into more the mid to high 30s rather than the low 40s we saw yesterday. But certainly hot conditions remain ahead. That it's humid as well under that blanket of cloud in the southeast as well, and hot conditions persist through parts of the north of, or from about Longreach there northward as well to the northern interior. And in fact, this heat is going to linger up here right way through the weekend and into the early part of next week. So that means severe heatwave conditions will slowly abate from the southeast over this weekend, though it will remain humid. But the severe heatwave conditions will continue up over parts of the northern interior, northwest, and the central interior as well, right the way through the weekend and into the early part of next week. So more days to come with temperatures hovering in the low 40s, really. So no real significant change expected up here, at least cool change anyway, into early next week.
And tell me, what's happening with that trough?
Yeah, indeed. The trough does extend from the northwest right down to the southeast, and it brought a subtly change to parts of the northwest as well, and a little rumble or two of thunder over the last 24 hours. The most active part of that trough is in the southeast, and it's also combining with a subtly change moving up the northern New South Wales coast. So it has the potential to generate severe storms in the southeast. Most of it, though, will probably be east of about Toowoomba. That's where we expect the severe storm risk to be really focused. And that's in more over the southeast coast itself. And some of that could be, severe. And there's a risk of some isolated, very dangerous storms. And that's with the potential to generate even large to giant hail and destructive wind gusts, particularly near the southeast coast, around the border ranges and Gold Coast hinterland particularly will be the watch point this afternoon. But broadly in the southeast, including areas south of the sunny, around the sunny coast south, there is a severe thunderstorm risk this afternoon and evening.
And in the midst of all that, the fire danger is quite high as well.
Yeah, indeed. Even with the slightly cooler change behind that trough, it still remains elevated fire dangers. Not quite extreme, but still highs with that drier southerly behind that trough as well. So really widespread high fire dangers throughout the interior of Queensland for today and over the next few days, you know, even north and south of that trough.
We've looked at the interior and the south. In the meantime, what's going on in the far north and in the north of the state?
Yeah, in the far north, very little in the way of shower activity up here. On the coast, you've got the afternoon sea breezes, which peg temps back more into the low 30s, but hot conditions away from that through much of inland northern Queensland as well. And we will see the heatwave conditions probably become more extensive up here. Severe heatwave conditions getting up into inland parts of the southern peninsula as well over the weekend, and may develop along the western peninsula as well as we go into the weekend and early next week.
And Phelan, what's happening on coastal waters?
Now, generally we've got a ridge in play, so that's keeping the coastal waters pretty benign in terms of winds up along most of the, particularly the northern half of the state as well. But it's further south. We've got a little bit of a fresher northerly airflow off the southeast. It's not a strong wind warning worthy, but it's keeping things a little bit fresher here. But further north, generally lighter winds with those afternoon sea breezes, which may be fresh at times along parts of the tropical east coast over the next day or two, just given all that heat inland.
Phelan Hanafy, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour, and local fire bans are also in place for 11 council areas across parts of the southwest and northern inland today. If you're in the Boulogne, Bulloo, Charters Towers, Croydon, Etheridge, Flinders, Gundawindi, Maranoa, Merway, Paroo, Quilpie or Richmond council areas, this applies to you. During fire bans, you're not allowed to light any fires in the open, but some exceptions do apply, including for power tools, lawn mowers and essential agricultural purposes. There are more details on what you can and can't do during a fire ban on the Queensland Fire Department website at fire.qld.gov.au. It's 22 to 1.
This week on Landline, meet the lettuce growers who went from price takers to price makers.
Could you ever imagine being a price taker again?
Not for me. No, that's not a position I ever want to be in again. So all the business we do in the future is going to be some sort of an agreed supply and price.
And could they be the cutest sheep on earth? That's Landline Sunday 12:30 on ABC TV and streaming on ABC iView.
And that story that you just heard with the stories is also online at abc.net.au/rural. You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour. The Federal Department of Agriculture has reported a stunning financial turnaround after it fell into major deficit last year. And part of the solution was hiking fees on industry, slashing consultancy costs and putting a freeze on hiring biosecurity officers. Emma Field crunched the numbers.
DAF reported a $22.7 million surplus for the year ending the 30th of June this year, compared to a $65.7 million loss last year. That's according to its recently released annual report. It achieved this by slashing consultancy costs, which ballooned last year to $27.5 million. This was reined in to $7.4 million. Last year, controversial consultancy firm PwC, which was recently raided by Australian Federal Police over a former employee disclosing confidential government tax information, was paid $7.6 million by DAF. But in the 2024 reporting year, the highest pay consultant was $903,605,000. Another reason DAF improved its bottom line was from an increase in biosecurity cost recovery income, which is where the government charges industry, importers and exporters for services it's required to provide. Total cost recovery revenue from importers, excluding Australia Post, was up almost 22% on last year to $365 million. The department also reported it missed 7 of its 12 key biosecurity targets, including calls to their national biosecurity hotline. They aim to answer 80% of calls within 5 minutes, but only 71% of these calls were answered in that time. For biosecurity inquiries made via the department's website, only 57% of these were answered within 10 business days, again missing their target of 80%. Sam Nelson from National Farmer Group Grain Growers says that's a concern.
The Australian biosecurity system relies on everyone, you know, in the general public potentially being a biosecurity officer and reporting something that they see as being unusual. And we need to have trust that someone is going to be at the other end of those calls. When someone sees something in their spice rack that looks a little bit odd, that's at the bottom of their jar, we need them to be able to have trust and faith that if they call up a Department of Ag helpline, that someone's going to answer when they contact the government on these issues.
The department blamed the missed targets on, quote, reduced biosecurity officer numbers. And in a statement, the department spokesman said,
there were budget impacts on recruiting during 2022 to 2023 financial year, which limited our ability to meet service standards for biosecurity clearances. But we expect more than 170 biosecurity staff to be recruited this year. An increase in e-commerce has seen the volume of goods imported into Australia grow dramatically over the past 5 years, more than doubling from 2018, with approximately 124 million consignments entering Australia in 2023-2024 financial year.
The federal government has pledged to boost biosecurity funding to the department by about $2 million a year by 2028. It will also lift cost recovery fees and allocate an additional $7 million a year to fund the assessment of incoming mail. But there's uncertainty over the future of the proposed biosecurity levy on Australian exports, which was blocked earlier this year in the Senate. Sam Nelson from Grain Growers again.
The biosecurity levy hasn't been completely taken off the cards, and I think that's something that the agricultural industries are still engaging and talking to the government about. You know, there was a really good move to actually increase biosecurity funding and address sort of some of the shortfall that we'd seen in biosecurity funding over past years. So we certainly have welcomed that uptick in funding from government.
Grain Growers is also pleased with the department's work on capra beetle, a serious threat to the country's grain industry, which is present in Asia, the Middle East and many European countries. The department reported 2 detections of the beetle at the border last financial year, one found in a plant carried by a traveller and one found amongst grain residue on a sea container floor from a country not known to have capra beetle. Grain Growers Sam Nelson says this is a great improvement.
I think it's very good that these detections have been picked up, and they've been picked up, you know, before they've come into the country or at the border. We had a situation a few years ago, 2021, when there were a very large number of incursions that were detected, and we saw the government put in place a number of actions to try and make sure that we dropped that number and capra beetle was being picked up and dealt with before it got to the country. So there are a number of actions around, you know, making sure that biosecurity officers were picking up any material that they detected at border on a passenger. But also there was a whole lot of work involved in understanding container movements, making sure containers were cleaned and understanding where those containers were going so that we could understand and deal with the risk before that it got to the country. So what we're seeing is a good news story. It's great that they were picked up, but you know, every time something arrives at the border, there is a risk that it might come through. So it's certainly not something to rest on your laurels about.
Grain Growers Technical Policy Manager Sam Nelson finishing that report. It's 1:45.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
In just a moment, you're going to meet a young couple who bucked the trend when they left the treadmill of their careers and became full-time market gardeners. You'll hear that great story very shortly. But first, it's no secret the mining industry significantly contributes to Australia's climate impact, making up almost one-third of the country's CO2 emissions. But as Abby Holter found out, a modern company is hoping its solution to reviving old abandoned mines could bring new life to the energy industry.
It sounds like a great idea for a romance novel. Enemies become lovers in the outback. Well, in red dirt country in northwest Queensland, the mining industry has turned a new page and started a working relationship with renewable energy companies. So why have the two decided to jump in bed together? It's got to do with empty, unused holes in the ground. The Mount Isa region is home to a plethora of mines, many abandoned and legacies, which is a mine that's been left without proper safety management. Instead of removing the infrastructure and turning the former mines into grazing land, renewable energy storage company Green Gravity are flipping the switch and turning them into decarbonising solutions. Executive Director Mark Swinnerton says there are tens of thousands of legacy mines across Australia, and most of the time they have no future uses once they've closed.
This is all about taking the electricity that's generated from a solar cell and finding a way to store it. And usually that's in a big battery. Our system is a mechanical system. It works much like pumped hydroelectricity. We use the legacy mine shaft and we lift heavy objects up the shaft when there's excess renewable energy. And so we progressively move them up. You don't destroy the electricity when you're using it. You just convert it into the gravitational potential energy of the mass. And so at a later time when we want to reuse it, we simply lower those masses back down the mine shaft. And by using a regenerative electrical motor, just like what we find in an electric vehicle, we're able to slow the descent of the mass and generate electricity back to the grid accordingly.
This technology is brand new, and Mr. Swinnerton believes Australia has the chance to spearhead this up-and-coming industry.
There is a huge need around the world for more storage, more energy storage, to get us through the night on renewables. And so we're in a huge race globally to bring technologies to market, and this is an opportunity for Australia to bring this specific technology to both our own grid but also across the world.
And it's not just Australia as a whole. Queensland, specifically the Northwest, is a gold mine for these companies.
This could exceed $1 billion of capital and investment over a decade into the region. We've got opportunities right there in Mount Isa. We're working directly with Glencore to examine the potential of utilising the mine shafts at the Mount Isa Copper Operations, and supported by Glencore, we've commenced early engineering concept study work. It could be as many as 350 jobs for an extended period. We think provisionally there's in excess of 2 gigawatt hours of energy storage available. This can decarbonise the bulk of emissions from the region as it pertains to the electricity consumption. It can generate large-scale, long-duration energy storage, which is a game changer to make the entire energy system carbon-free and do so economically.
Green Gravity aren't the only renewable energy organisation digging around for opportunities. Mining research company Enviromets has brought their expertise to the outback region. Executive Director Alan Morton says the company have funding to develop mine repurposing possibilities in the northwest and central Queensland and the Bowen Basin.
First of all, we can get further mineral extraction out of these sites. There's a lot of new technology. The second one is there's non-mining commercial operations that can look at it and say, well, actually, we'd like to use the site for a this or a that. The third one is there's a value proposition for a government to maintain a town or grow a town or maintain those communities. There's also the value propositions for environmental and cultural and heritage.
While the business prospects can go national, Mr. Morton says he wants Queensland to lead the way.
We want to be able to say, okay, we've got one or two sites in regional northwest. We've got one or two sites in central Queensland. We've got one or two sites in the Bowen Basin. We would like to set those pilot sites and have them up by 2027. I want to see Queensland do and show the world what we can do with our imagination and our innovation. We are the largest concentration of METS, which is the mining equipment technology and services companies in the world. Imagine if we have a pilot site that has three or four things happening on that site, and we have Queensland companies that are developing technology. All of a sudden, that whatever they develop can go global. Under the current regulatory framework, the mining company actually has to remove it. And we're saying, why do you have to remove it? Why can't we reuse that? And so what we need is people who are in the regions who have a real vested interest in these futures. This is not stuff for a shiny tower. This is people with some dust on their boots.
But there's more than just scientific applications for abandoned mines. Dr. Peter Whitbread-Abritat is a leading global advisor in mine site rehabilitation, with a PhD in revegetation of mine waste from the University of Exeter's Camborne School of Mines, and he spent the better part of his life travelling the globe, researching alternative ways to regenerate mines.
So many opportunities, especially in a place like Mount Isa. You can see when you walk through it, there's so many opportunities about doing some potentially really wonderful new ideas around new kinds of activity on mining sites. I understand there's a few well-trodden tourist trails that people use, including through Mount Isa. There's potentially a lot of new mines in the future as well, new mines around serving the green industrial revolution that's coming around the corner. For example, if you're in North Wales, you can go underground trampolining in an old slate cavern.
Oh, really?
Or play underground golf. If you're in northern Italy in the Alps, an old underground copper mine, which a local cheese making cooperative stores up to 30,000 dustbin lid sized cheeses. Good ideas can come from anywhere, as long as the system around how we plan mine closure and all the rest of it enables those ideas to be considered and worked into something.
There you go, from cheese making to a giant underground trampoline park. All the options for rehabilitated mine sites. That is leading global advisor in mine site rehabilitation, Dr. Peter Whitbread-Abritat, ending that report from Abby Holter. And you can read more about that story and see some photos online at abc.net.au/rural. It's 8 to 1.
A beetle, a bee, or a butterfly? The ABC is on a mission to find which bug will be crowned ABC Australian Insect of the Year, and you get to decide. Just go online and type in ABC Insect of the Year, read all about your six-legged contenders, and then vote for your favourite. It's that easy. The winner will be announced during Australian Pollinator Week on the 9th of November, so get busy choosing your best backyard buddy.
You're listening to The Country Hour. Jodie Gunders with you through until 1 o'clock today. Riley and Lachlan Hughes, I want to introduce you to them. They bucked the trend when they left the treadmill of their careers to become full-time market gardeners in a region where suburbia is squeezing out farmland. For decades, their family's land hadn't run much more than a few cows. Jennifer Nichols visited the brothers for a Young Farmers Connect field day and learned they only put the tractor in their plots once a year.
Picking fresh, chemical-free greens, the Hughes brothers have revived their family's farm at Woombye in the Sunshine Coast hinterland.
Hi, I'm Riley Hughes from Honey Eater Farm.
Hi, I'm Lachlan Hughes from Honey Eater Farm in Woombye.
What a place you've got here. You're surrounded by a lot of subdivision now, but in the past, this used to be prime pineapple country, and tucked away off Palmwood's Montville Road, you've got a thriving market garden.
Yeah, our grandfather moved from Mackay in 1950, and at the time he didn't even know what a pineapple was, and he started farming this land before moving into avocados, all whilst working at the sugar factory in Nambour. And the land sat vacant for about 20 years. We just slashed it and had cattle. And then in 2021, we decided to join together in a partnership to start a market garden.
We primarily sell at Pomona Country Markets on a Saturday morning.
And do you juggle this with other jobs?
No, we're doing this full time at the moment, and we take summer off because of the weather here on the Sunshine Coast.
So how old are you both?
I am 33.
I'm 35.
Can we have a quick look down and tell me some of the crops that are around us?
Absolutely. So just here we've got some broccoli. So we'll snip the heads out of that when that starts flowering, and we'll harvest that as a baby broccoli. We've got curly kale, silver beet, zucchinis, leeks, beans, fennel, kohlrabi, English spinach, cos lettuce, bok choy.
We got some tatsoi, potatoes, coriander, carrots. Yeah, there's quite a large, diverse range.
And how much ground have you got under production?
It's about 2,000 square metres, which I think is about a quarter acre. I guess we'd consider the business still in its startup phase. We're just figuring out the best way to sell in terms of whether it's farmers market, direct to customers, community supported agriculture, and what size of land will allow us to sustain ourselves. But for a small farm like us, diversity is key. So having a diverse range of crops allows us to be flexible in what people want, but also changes in the weather and the season.
You're always so vulnerable when you're a farmer because the weather dictates everything. Pests can be a real problem. I notice you've got an electric fence around, no doubt, to keep the hares out.
That's right. We've been fairly fortunate, I reckon. But yeah, it was hares last year.
Yeah, we've had wallabies.
And a wild dog which decided to chew up irrigation and damage things like that, yeah.
Ever had a hailstorm here? That would just be shivers down my spine when I look at all these beautiful leafy greens.
Yeah, I think the first year in spring, we had a hailstorm and lost quite a lot of lettuce and bok choy. From a distance, it looked fine. And then when we came down to inspect the damage, right down the centre, the hail had hit and split all the bok choy open. And that was only a few months into our growing. So, yep, that was an experience.
And what did you do before you came back to the property?
I was an electrical engineer doing mining services.
And I was working in local government as an urban forester. I studied horticulture, and as part of that I did an urban horticulture course. So I got a bit of exposure to this style of market gardening.
Now, you've got the Young Farmers Connect meeting here on your farm today. What does it mean to you to be part of that movement?
Well, for us, attending Young Farmers Connect events in the lead up to us starting this farm was crucial in us forming ideas on how we would farm and connecting with other growers.
Yeah, when we were starting up, we visited a lot of farms. So it's nice to, after a few years, show everybody our farm using the knowledge that we learnt off of all of their farms.
And when you told your mates that you're going to be doing this, what did they think?
I think they knew that we had a family history of farming, so it wasn't that unusual, but I guess it was unusual in our career pivots. Yeah.
I think access to land suitable for farming is probably one of the main barriers. I'm sure we'd have a lot more people in it if they did have access to suitable land.
And I suppose that's part of what the discussions can be with this sort of group, is perhaps leasehold arrangements, share farming.
Yeah, and I think we also recognise that small businesses like ours on their own are probably stronger when we can form cooperatives with other farms, have a diverse range of produce, access other markets. What we really tried to do this year, which is our third season, is to apply lean principles to our farming enterprise. And that means really scaling it back, only working the hours that we need to, and implementing standards and procedures that make the farming more efficient and less waste.
And how has that worked for you?
I guess in one sense it's worked well, but unfortunately market garden enterprise is heavily reliant. So we farm what they call human scale, so not a lot of machinery, so most things done by hand.
We've got the broadfork here.
Yeah, that's right. We've got a broadfork here. So we do rotary hoe with a tractor once a year. That's to till our cover crop in over summer. But then for the rest of the year, all the beds are prepared by hand. And as I was saying earlier, applying lean principles was great. We were able to pull back on a lot of things, but I've been sick for a significant portion of time. So I'll be honest, most of what you see here is thanks to Riley's hard work. And I guess it's a testament to his ability to, you know, apply those principles and be efficient with what he does.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? It's all on your backs when you're doing something like this.
Yeah, there's no paid sick days when you're a farmer in a partnership. The veggies need to be harvested and sold in a short amount of time. So sometimes you just have to knuckle down and get it done.
So are you certified organic here?
No, not yet, but the plan is to be certified organic.
You must be very proud when you look around and see how healthy your veggies look.
It's quite nice, especially today.
Yeah, definitely. I think like when you compare it to when we first started, we try not to think about things that we can't control. I guess that's a main thing when you're farming, is that there's a lot of risk and a lot of things external to what you can control. So you just try and manage and mitigate that risk. And I guess, yeah, diversity in what crops we have is probably one of the key ones. If anyone is ever interested in becoming a farmer or changing careers, definitely get connected with Young Farmers Connect. They hold open days and field days throughout the year, and that is a really good opportunity for you to see real farms in action and to get a feel for exactly what it is like to farm. But if you've ever run a small business, I'd say it's a fairly similar thing. There's a lot of sacrifice for a lot of years before you can achieve sustainability.
Lachlan Hughes, who with his brother Riley runs Honey Eater Farm on the Sunshine Coast, and Jennifer Nichols did that story. She's quite correct. It's a beautiful property. You can see it yourself by going to the ABC Rural website, abc.net.au/rural. That story is up there today. Lovely photos of that property. Also some lovely historical photos. It's great when you see photos of a place like the Sunshine Coast. It's so developed now, but when you can see these beautiful little pockets of farmland, some great historical photos there, also of the brothers when they were little. So you can find that story online at abc.net.au/rural. That is your lot, my lot, the Country Hour's lot for today. Thank you so much for joining me, and I'll look forward to catching up with you. Or Kelly Buchanan will be back with you on Monday. Have a wonderful weekend. It's almost time for the news. It's coming up to 1 o'clock.